From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. It's been a short week with the holiday, but we have a lot to share with you.
And before we really get rolling, I want to start with one of the best things ever on the show. Artist Sean Dunwoody came in and he bared his soul for us. He really did. He grew up in Rochester, got kicked out of school twice, sold drugs, but told the story about how art saved him. Now, later in this podcast, we'll get to more of that story. But first, I want to play for you his answer to a question that I asked about when he first realized he was creative and could create art. His answer is absolutely the last thing I expected to hear.
I was about 5 years old. I'm a big fan of Spider-Man. And so I had a cassette tape case and I crushed these spiders up in there. You know, I collect them out of the cobwebs and I had a sewing needle and I had a plug that I cut the tip off. So my idea was to create radioactive spider blood and inject myself. Luckily, my mom caught me and I was like, okay, this is crazy. So later on, I started, you know, mimicking the comic book artists that I enjoyed and painting their work and reproducing what they did from Spider-Man to Hulk to Superman. And I realized I could be a superhero on paper. And then that translated into walls and that translated into the canvas of the city of Rochester itself. So even though I can't leap from a tall building from a single bound, doggone it, if you give us a skyjack, we'll take care of it.
I love that. I was a Batman kid. You were probably not a comic book kid.
No, but I know who Batman is.
That's very exciting. You know who Spider-Man is. Did you know the radioactive spider blood story? Peter Parker was bitten by a radioactive spider, which is how he got his powers.
Oh, that's right. I do remember that.
Okay. With great
power. I better go to RockCon this weekend. I could learn a lot there.
You could learn a lot there. With great power comes great responsibility. Speaking of responsibility, let's turn to another subject here, Megan Mack.
Yes, now let's turn to the cost of higher education. Last month, Nazareth College President Don Braveman said that we're all getting it wrong, that the actual price students pay for college is not going through the roof.
Now, we asked him to come back on the show and elaborate, and so he did. And it turns out the numbers show he's essentially right. The sticker price for college has gone way up in recent years, but most students don't pay the full price. And when you factor in all the aid, the actual net price is going up around 2% per year.
But that doesn't answer the question, why are fewer poor students going to college? If there's so much aid available, why isn't it reaching lower income families? Here's Don Braveman's answer.
We've made a concerted effort to really expand access. One of the things we started a couple years ago is to try to create access for students from high-performing high schools throughout New York State. So we now have a partner, and actually it extends beyond New York. We have a partnership with three schools in Brooklyn. We have a partner in New York City and actually Brooklyn Bronx as well. We have a partnership with a school in Philadelphia. These are high-performing urban schools. Students are very poor, but the kids are terrific students.
I mentioned that author Malcolm Gladwell has been going after higher education in his podcast series, Revisionist History, and he's been going after amenities, things like sparkling high-end dorms, profligate spending, I guess, but especially food. Gladwell compared Bowdoin and Vassar. Bowdoin has, in Gladwell's words, a world-class chef and nearly a Michelin star. Vassar has soggy pizza, but because Bowdoin spends so much on dining, he says it offers significantly less in Pell grants. About 24% of Vassar students are on Pell, 12% at Bowdoin. And let's, in a second, John, if we could, let's listen to what Malcolm Gladwell concludes about the amenities race and Bowdoin versus Vassar.
There's only one solution. If you're looking at liberal arts colleges, don't go to Bowdoin. Don't let your kids go to Bowdoin. Don't let your friends go to Bowdoin. Don't give money to Bowdoin or to any other school that serves amazing food in its dining hall. Because every time you support a school that spends its money on amazing food, every time you cast a vote in favor of eggplant parmesan pancakes and lobster bakes and venison during deer season, you're making it harder and harder for someone like Catherine Hill to create opportunities for poor kids.
All right. I know you haven't listened to the whole episode there, Don, but he's saying you can't go to Bowdoin because...
Well, go to Nazareth. That's what I say.
Because they have... Listen, what Gladwell's saying is they have... schools like Bowdoin have prioritized catering to the families that want a Michelin star dining hall, super high-end dorms that look like nice hotels, and that when you do that, he thinks the evidence shows fewer low-income kids get help. Is that too broad a conclusion or is there something to it?
It's so not our experience. I mean, the only climbing wall at Nazareth is in my office, and I'm the only one who climbs up it. But to be serious for a moment, 10 years ago, we made a decision that if we're going to invest in new facilities, they are going to be academic.
We're going to stay on the college campus because this week we also discussed trigger warnings. The University of Chicago sent a letter to incoming freshmen warning them that there would be no trigger warnings and no so-called safe spaces.
That letter set off a nationwide debate over the growing practice of trigger warnings. What are they, and are they appropriate? We welcomed Dr. Elizabeth Thorpe, a Brockport professor who has written about trigger warnings. You'll hear from her, but first you'll hear from Christina Summers of the American Enterprise Institute. She's been a consistent critic of trigger warnings, and she offered her reaction to the University of Chicago's letter.
Oh, I was very pleased and timed to see some leadership from college presidents and administrators, so I was heartened. I taught philosophy for more than 20 years. Now, perhaps it's not a topic that creates conditions for PTSD, but it never occurred to me to spare my students readings. And actually, in some cases, we did read things that could be distressing. And I don't approach my students, I didn't think of them as fragile mental patients. Now, it's possible there are fragile, I'm sure there are people who have suffered trauma, and I very much welcome counseling and, you know, it, just to have campus take care of them in the counseling service. But in the classroom, except in the most extraordinary of case, there's no place for trigger warnings.
Let me go ahead and at least try to define what a trigger warning is. And I'm going to ask Dr. Thorpe to do that because in the paper that you wrote on the subject, you noted that there are kind of varied definitions if you read different articles, in fact, on different campuses, talking to different professors. Sometimes you hear that a trigger warning described as a warning to students about materials, perhaps a reading, a book, a lecture, that could be upsetting or distressing. You know, for example, professors at Oxford University this past spring told students the following. According to several news outlets, students studying law at Oxford were told they could walk out of lectures that included any discussion of violence or death if the students felt that those subjects would be too distressing. And the Daily Mail reports that before lectures on sexual offenses, which include crimes such as rape and sexual assault, students were advised that the content could be distressing, and that they were given the opportunity to leave. But I know that you sort of take issue with the idea of just distressing or uncomfortable versus triggering, and you wanted to narrow the definition, so go ahead.
Right. I feel like it becomes very easy to critique trigger warnings when you talk about a trigger warning as something like, oh, this is going to be an offensive conversation, therefore I must warn you. Yes, that does infantilize students, and you open it up for criticism, obviously, there, because we don't want to infantilize our students in the classroom. But a trigger warning is called a trigger warning because it's a triggering conversation. And that's where, just as she said, we're talking about people who have had traumatizing issues in their past. Trauma is something very specific, right? It can trigger physical reactions to the conversation, something like an anxiety attack, PTSD issues. If that's what we're talking about, then a trigger warning is something very specific. You are dealing with topics, with conversations, something that could cause a reaction that a student really can't assess the information appropriately, can't deal with the information in a way that allows them to be a good student. And if that's what we're talking about, that's very different than just saying, oh, this is difficult information. Everybody be careful. We're going to have a controversial discussion. A college classroom is a place for controversial discussion. So I feel like it's very easy to critique trigger warnings when we diminish what they really are. And I've been characterized as being anti-trigger warning when, in fact, I feel like I'm a little bit more sympathetic to the idea that we should prepare our students if we're talking about something that is potentially fraught in terms of students who have traumatizing histories. The problem, of course, is knowing what is going to be traumatizing.
We'll turn now to a little nostalgia, but not just a little nostalgia. Vinyl is making a comeback.
And not just because people want to kind of go back in time or relive their childhood. Vinyl sales have been going up for the past decade now, indicating it's not just a fad. Most other audio formats are struggling. We discuss why that is with Dick Storms, founder of the Record Archive in Rochester, Chris Wilford, a former professional musician and vinyl aficionado, and Frank DeBlaze, a longtime local musician, writer, and photographer.
It's that tangible thing. You get into these bits and bobs and whatever. They're just floating out there in space. A record is a thing. It's
exactly.
A tangible connection to the artist. It's a top of mind activity. It's social glue. Gatefolds are great for various things.
It's often brought up when the discussions take place about people forgetting how relaxing and pleasant it is to lean back with that album jacket.
Oh my gosh!
And read a liner note, or really appreciate cover art.
I'm holding a
copy. Lost in CD in the digital.
The thing is, with records, there's not as many pictures, so the pictures have that much more impact.
I'm holding the 86 years of Ubi Blake, who was a great ragtime pianist who went on to write for theater and wrote I'm Just Wild About Harry, and they're doing a Broadway show about him right now, Shuffle Along. And this thing just does the entire history of Ubi Blake in a fold-out cover. It's just a wonderful thing, yeah, and the type is big enough to read for me and eventually for Evan over here.
And so you can roll the doobie and listen to Ubi.
We'll wrap the week by going back to artist Sean Dunwoody. A new documentary tells his story and the story of how art can help impoverished neighborhoods overcome challenges. Here's Dunwoody taking us back to his childhood in Rochester.
I grew up in the city. I grew up on Avenue D is where I actually grew up. Grew up on Avenue D, then moved to Portland and Bay. And, you know, you're a teenage kid. I was tossed out of two high schools. I don't know if I should say their name, but I will. I was tossed out of Edison and East. At the time, there was a Josh Lofton school, and that they were like, "No, you're just not even gonna go there. You're just not gonna make it in school." And I was like, "Okay." I had to get my GED. I was already a dad as well at the time, so it's like, "Oh man, what's life gonna do? How do I take care of my children? How do I take care of life?" The next best thing to do. I don't have much of an education. I don't have too many skills, so I did a little bit of slinging on the corner. So I could tell you where my spot was. It was a corner store in the corner of Bay.
What did you sell?
I sold a weed initially. Then I experimented a bit with crack cocaine. That didn't move well.
It didn't move well?
No, it didn't move well.
Okay.
It didn't move well. The pre-cook didn't work for some reason. I don't know why. And I did sold some dimes of cocaine. Did do that. I was in a gate. For those people out there who know what that is, Walt, if you're listening to me, bro, I love you, man. I love you. Walt was the cat who had an apartment up above on Bay. I actually graduated, went to Brockport, and he used to tell me, he said, "You don't want this life. You don't want to be here." As they sat around and cooked up the cocaine, watching another cat in the corner, you know, doing heroin. Literally, these things are going on.
And you're how old? And when was this here?
I'm 17. I'm 17.
You're 17 years old?
Yeah, 17 years old. Okay. So these things are actually happening, but there was still the backside of me, which is the front side of me now. Does that make any sense? The artist side. I was always a creative person. I was always wanted to be engaged in the arts and creative. So my elementary school years, I went to parochial school. St. Stanislaus Kostka, my Polish people out there, actually did a project in Poland, and St. Stanislaus helped support that as well, a mural project. And then I went to high school. I was bored, wanted to do things creative. You know, things happen, dogs in school, fires, all kinds of stuff. I won't go into detail.
That's why you got thrown out?
There's a long list. There's a long list of other reasons why, which I could have probably gone to jail for harassment and various other things of teachers and staff. But so I took the curiosity that tossed me out, but I was still creative. And so, you know, even hanging out, I still had, at the time, we had an airbrushed and painted pants. I had my pants on, or I'd have a rhinestone studded Band-Aid on. Who the heck was a rhinestone studded Band-Aid? But I took the time to do that. Chicken bones around my neck, for those people who remember that. Even tying my belt, my clothes up with rope. I was just trying to be creative and express myself. So while I'm out there, you know, we're hanging with cats, and I'm hanging with the cats, and we're talking, doing our thing. They're like, "Man, what's up with you? You just ain't looking right. You don't need to be out here. What's going on?"
So hold on. I got to jump in here and say, the story you're telling right now, you expressed in the film, and I thought this was a remarkable moment. You talk about slinging drugs with other people who are telling you on the street, you shouldn't be selling drugs, you should be in art.
Yes.
I thought that was amazing because it's your story, but it also humanized other people who are selling drugs because we tend to paint with a broad brush. We assume, oh, well, you know, worthless drug dealers, the way we talk about people, those are human beings. Mm-hmm. And they saw in you a very human talent. They didn't want you out there with them selling drugs.
That's correct, because everyone could tell, "You got talent, bro." When I walk up with my pants on, painted up, like, "All right, this is skill." And everybody, "Hey, I want you to draw a picture of my mama," and all these kind of things. So there was always there was actually a push from the corner to leave the corner.
Wow.
That's why even now when I come across people as adults, they're like, "Man, you always had it in you. You always had that skill. I'm glad." You said, "You're repping the block, you're making me proud." A lot of people have said that. So fast forward, now how I want to engage with individuals is to be the person I wanted to see when I was 17. I didn't see the guy that was out there painting or employing young people or really expressing himself and wasn't afraid to express himself. So now I try to create a path that I become what I wanted to see so that in some way, shape, or form, I can influence someone to continue to beautify our city and our world.
You can watch the documentary Confronting the Wall on Monday, September 12th at 9 p.m. on WXXI-TV.
And you can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
You can always find us on the WXXI mobile app as well. She's Megan Mack, producer. I'm host Evan Dawson. Have a lovely weekend, and we will talk with you Monday on member-supported public radio.